FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. The date is September 12th, 2016. And hey, unless your head has been in the sand, well, yesterday was a special day, a memorial to the 15th year anniversary of 9/11. I'm sure you all remember where you were that day. I know I do, and I'll never forget it. But unless your head was in the sand, you know that Hillary had a health episode, and they're spinning it for all it's worth, but that thing is dead in the water, at least in my opinion. Stefan Molyneux, Cernovitz's opinion, so many others. Dilbert's creator, Scott Adams. I mean, the optics couldn't have been any worse, but John Rubino, master at these judging these things, dollarcollapse.com, with us now. John, hey, good to have you back as always. Happy Monday.
Hey, Kerry. I think we're going to need to extend the length of our session today.
Okay. Well,
between the Fed and Hillary and three or four other things. Oh, the ECB crazy stuff. We've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we do. So first, Hillary, though. I mean, that is the topic. Thank goodness for YouTube. Some guy captured it. It was actually three different videos captured. So she doesn't look too good. She's wearing these Zeiss eyeglasses. That's what some of the people out there say, that are especially out there to stop you from having seizures. And it wasn't sunny out there. It was an overcast day, high 70s, low 80s. The audience in this group is in the shade. I believe they're shaded by a tent or something. And she's not feeling too good after 90 minutes, has to leave. They catch her on camera being literally like, looks like she goes into a seizure. Then she's like thrown into the van. Now, that's another thing. Vans, generally, political candidates don't use vans. They're in SUVs, Suburbans or large SUVs, Ford Excursions, because those vehicles are much more resistant to attacks. They're much more maneuverable. They're much faster than a van. Vans are for like soccer moms or for like handicapped people. This is like a handicapped person's van, John. And that van is the tip off right there that all is not well. And they throw her into the van. One of the pictures got a piece of metal coming out of her pantsuit falling on the ground, a tubular piece of metal. Was it part of a catheter? Was it her EpiPen? I don't know the answer to it, but it's definitely a mystery. And now the rumors are spreading that the DNC would like to replace her. And I think the only way they will replace Hillary is over her dead body. And there's rumors about that too, but so far, we wish her a speedy recovery, if it's at all possible, from whatever malady she's suffering from. But this is the big story, and I think it's affecting the markets too, John.
Well, now they're calling it pneumonia. Originally, they said she was overheated. And, you know, this ties so tightly back into the last few weeks of people, you know, putting up videos about her head shaking and her having to be helped to and from cars and things like that. And that was passed off by the mainstream media as right-wing conspiracy mongering. but now we kind of have to put that to bed and admit that she has some health issues. And, you know, a few weeks ago, there was a lot of discussion about whether Trump was going to have to quit because his poll numbers were plunging, his campaign was in turmoil, he was hiring and firing campaign executives right and left, and now we've got Hillary maybe having issues with her health that are serious enough for people to contemplate having to replace her at this really late date in the in the campaign. So we've never seen anything like this from a pure political theater standpoint. I think it would be hilarious if they both had to leave the campaign with a month left.
And well, and you know what? It really fits into your theme of how ungovernable we all are as a nation, because they can't even field candidates that are stable enough to make it through to November, physically, mentally, whatever. I mean, I think that, well, that was a lot of garbage. Trump this, Trump that, not happening. But I think they were preparing us for something here. And I mean, you just shake your head because we've never had an election season like this before, have we?
No, we really haven't. And it does reflect on our financial situation, really. You know, when you screw up a country's finances, the politics come along for the ride. And that's what we're seeing here and around the world, where candidates that you wouldn't have thought would make it all the way to the finish line, getting a lot of votes in a lot of different countries. You know, Brexit obviously is the big story that actually happened rather than just almost happened. And the rest of the world is seeing similar kinds of situations where formerly fringe candidates are rising and becoming powerful politicians or powerful parties. And the reason for that is that people realize that the system isn't working for them anymore.
Yeah.
So they're open to suggestion now. If somebody wants to tear the system out by the roots and start over, yeah, okay, why not? You know, and so what we're seeing here in the US has some interesting, unique twists because of Trump's unique personality and Hillary's health issues. But
yeah,
still, it's kind of par for the course with what's going on in the rest of the world. And it all goes back to the fact that we've borrowed too much money over the last 30 or 40 years. And now everything is in chaos. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the stats on, for instance, what middle class workers make now versus what they made 20 or 30 years ago, it's less in real terms. Yeah. And that right there will lead to political chaos, because people who don't feel like they're progressing and actually feel like they're regressing, for instance, if your salary doesn't go up but your healthcare costs quadruple, mm-hmm. your life is harder than it used to be. And that's not the way it's supposed to be in the US. We're supposed yes. to progress. Our kids are supposed to do better than us, and we're supposed to do better than our parents. And when you take that away, and we really have taken that away over the last couple of decades, then people's political preferences change. And that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing a shift towards iconoclasts. And Hillary might be the last rock solid mainstream candidate that we field for quite some time, you know, and her situation is so dicey that we might not even end up fielding her now. We'll have to see how she emerges from the hospital yeah. over the next few days. But it really does look like these debates between her and Trump have an even more extreme layer of political theater to them, because we don't know if she's going to be able to make it through 90 minutes under hot lights and not have a coughing fit or just keel over. And that's not the kind of thing that we've ever seen before in political campaigns. Even with Reagan the second time around, he was an old man by the standards of the day, but he rose to the occasion. You know, he didn't mm-hmm. pass out. Nothing happened to him physically during debates or during a fairly grueling campaign in his second campaign. But this time around, Hillary is somebody that you can't count on for stuff like that anymore. So, wow, I don't know what to say. And beyond that, it's completely unpredictable and in a really bad way. Most of what we see happening now is bad, you know, the extreme stuff in this campaign. We were seeing Donald Trump say things that freak out even his supporters. And we're seeing Hillary have to be carried to and from places because mm-hmm. she's collapsing. So, yeah, it's only going to get crazier as time goes on, I think.
Yeah, well, craziness is going on all over the world here. I mean, look what's happening with the Fed. They don't know what to say or what to do here. Where's that one going to end here?
Well, see, I think that's the really big story. On Friday, last Friday, the financial markets basically told the Fed what's going to happen if they raise rates. You know, stocks fell by almost 400 points on the Dow, and bond yields went up instead of down, which breaks a 30-year trend in falling bond yields. And that can be traced back to the fact that the Fed is supposedly getting ready to raise interest rates. this month. And so they found out that they can't really do that. The financial markets will spin off into absolute chaos if we try to raise interest rates. So now you've got these talking heads, some of whom I've never heard of. We have a lot of Fed governors. Did you know that, Kerry? It seems like there must be 100 of them, because somebody with a name that I've never heard comes out every few days and says something that contradicts the person who spoke the week before. And that's still happening. This morning, somebody came out and said something that kind of put the markets at ease a little bit. So now you've got relatively stable markets in the U.S. after Europe and Asia absolutely fell apart. And the reason for that is that now maybe we won't raise interest rates in September. But then if we push it off to December, we just wait 2 months and then have another Friday like we just had, which causes the Fed to backtrack again. You know, I think the other central banks of the world are basically doing what central banks feel like they have to do in this world. The Fed is really an outlier. You've got Europe, the European Central Bank now, buying Italian junk bonds, among many other assets. And you've got
assets, charitable. Describing them as an asset is really, really, I don't know what you would call the things, but an asset, not in this world.
And that's wrong on so many levels. First of all, it's incredibly risky with taxpayer money. I mean, if a hedge fund came out and said they'd loaded up on Italian junk bonds, you'd have a lot of their clients pulling the money out because it's just too risky. It's a crazy thing to do. Italian bonds in the first place are bad news, but Italian junk bonds are pretty much worthless paper, fundamentally speaking. And to use taxpayer money to buy them in order to keep the Italian economy and the Greek economy and the Portuguese economy and the Spanish economy from imploding is kind of putting a Band-Aid on a shotgun wound, really. That's not going to fix anything. And it distorts markets in the process, because capitalism works mainly through failure, to put it bluntly. Badly run companies not only, you know, frequently fail, but they should fail. That's their function. You know, you screw up, you push the envelope and you fail and you tell everybody else what not to do. You know, you show the system what works and what doesn't
work.
But if
competition, and that good stuff.
Exactly. You have to have freedom to fail if there is going to be freedom to succeed. And that's what we're taking away now by allowing, first of all, our big banks in the U.S. to take on any level of risk and grow to any size, safe in the knowledge that they're going to be bailed out. So the banking system has no idea what works and what doesn't work anymore. And that's why you get these crazy levels of leverage out there. Now we're extending that to basically any company anywhere, apparently, where the central bank is going to come in and buy their bonds and in that way bail them out. You know, if you buy risky companies' bonds, you basically give them free financing or very cheap financing, and that allows them to extend what is a dysfunctional business model to new areas and to keep on limping along. And so their competitors can't tell by looking at that whether that's a good business model or a bad business model. And so they don't know what to do, you know? And so you get massive misallocations of capital, which inevitably leads to an even bigger bust somewhere down the road. That's what Europe is doing right now.
Yeah.
Japan is buying equities. You know, they're one of the biggest, the Japanese Central Bank is one of the biggest holders of a long list of blue chip equities in the Japanese market and apparently in other markets too. And so that's distorting the marketplace because they buy indiscriminately. If you're a big company, they buy some of your stock. That pushes your stock up. And so no matter how well or badly run you are, you see yourself being rewarded by the market. Your competitors see you being rewarded by the marketplace. And so they can't tell whether something is a good business model or not, or this activity or that activity is something they should be engaging in. So again, massive, massive misallocations of capital. And so the system is being set up for a crisis of epic proportions.
Just what Ludwig von Mises said, you know, when you create all this money, you get malinvestment. But who thought it was going to occur this way, in this manner? Nobody ever believed it could occur this way here, John.
But do you think governments would be doing it, Kerry? That's just crazy.
Yeah, it's madness. It's a total madhouse. It just reminds me of what was that? Planet of the Apes, where Charlton Heston's undergoing hydrotherapy at the end of a fire hose, and he goes, "It's a madhouse," and we're in madhouse economics here. I mean, it's lunacy here, John. There's no other way to describe this thing.
Yeah. Well, the guys in charge are operating with flawed models. The Keynesian economic model says if you lower interest rates and then you print more money, the economy will do XYZ. But of course, beyond a certain point, money creation and leverage stop working. You know that from your own life, right? If you borrow $500,000, maybe you can put it to productive use. But if you borrow $20 million and keep doing the same things with it, you know, buying new houses, buying new cars, your quality of life doesn't improve, but the money that you're going to owe going forward goes way up, right? And that's basically what the world has done, what the way major governments of the world anyhow have done. They've just borrowed more and more money, thinking that they were going to get the same results from each new dollar borrowed. And that's not the way it's working. The marginal productivity of debt has dropped basically to zero now. So we can borrow as much as we want, and all we get for it is higher interest charges going forward. Mm-hmm. And so now, you know, it's over now, basically. The only thing that that has to happen now is for the general markets to figure out that it's over. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, we get a world like Friday becoming the new normal, where everything is plunging and volatility is through the roof and nobody knows what works anymore. Nobody has any idea where to put their money because the markets don't exist as signaling mechanisms anymore. So you can't look at any relationship out there between different financial assets and know which one you should buy and which one you should sell, or which business you should buy, or which factory you should build or not build. You can't know any of those things anymore. So capitalism, as we used to know it, as a means of efficiently allocating capital, is over. And all we have left is just massive, massive amounts of debt that we have to deal with somehow.
And, you know, there's only three ways to deal with it, right? Liquidate it liquidating it, but there's only three ways to liquidate. And that is number one, inflate it out of existence. Number two is go bankrupt. Or number three is default, right? Which I guess is one and the same. So you're either going to renegotiate it downward, which is a kind of debt forgiveness, or you're going to default on it. But one way or the other, or a jubilee, right? Which is just mass forgiveness, right? I mean, what's the difference here when you get down
to it? A debt jubilee is probably a variation of the inflated away theme, right? Because you're creating lots of new money and you're using it to buy back debt and retire the debt. But you're, of course, replacing that debt with a different kind of debt, which is paper money. You know, a dollar is just an IOU.
Yeah. Debt-based currency.
It's a claim on resources. You can take that piece of paper, which is otherwise meaningless, and you can turn it into real stuff as long as the relative supplies of the paper money and real stuff are in balance. But when the supply of fiat currency, of make-believe money, goes up to a certain point relative to the stuff that you can buy with it, then you get inflation. Then you get rising prices, which is really a loss of confidence in the value of the currency. And then we're in the Weimar Germany scenario. You know, the two choices you sketched out are basically a 1930s style deflationary depression or a 1920s style Weimar Germany hyperinflation. And that's basically what we're looking at out there, because neither alternative is attractive from the point of view of somebody who's trying to stay in office, you know, or keep his nice cushy job at the Fed. they're dithering because they don't want either one of those things to happen, but they see now that they're at that crossroad where they have to kind of choose one. And given who they are and the form of economics that they've studied for their basically entire lifetimes, they're going to choose the inflationary path. And we see that in Europe and Japan already. That's already happening, and to an extent in China. And it's just now up to the US to join that party. And then the floodgates open, right? When once everybody realizes that austerity is over, we're going to have big deficits for as far as the eye can see, and the central banks of the world are going to finance those deficits with newly created currency basically forever because there is no alternative, then the floodgates open in which financial capital flows into real assets.
Yeah.
So we'll see gold and silver gap up by massive amounts, you know, $10 an ounce in silver in a single day, $100 an ounce in gold, and probably other real assets like farmland and high quality energy assets and good real estate that's not already in bubble territory. Things like that will go up too, because you know the money has to go somewhere. And gold and silver cannot accept all the financial assets that are out there. You know, there's orders of magnitude more paper wealth than real wealth in the world. And so unless you want to see gold go to $100,000 an ounce, some of that capital has to go somewhere else. So there's a broad-based real asset play out there when the Fed finally capitulates. And so the question becomes, will it be this time around? You know, is September when they finally announce, never mind, we're not going to raise interest rates. We're going to cut interest rates at some point out there. And maybe negative interest rates will help with our problems. And once they start talking that way, then you want to be fully invested in real assets at that point. You know, you don't want to wait to that point, because a lot of the stuff that you were thinking about buying will be unavailable at almost any price. So we're getting close to the point where you've just got to be fully invested in gold, silver, some well-chosen real estate, et cetera, and just ride it. You know, if you're wrong for 6 months, that's okay, because you'll be right out there. And when you're right, it's going to be spectacular.
Oh, yeah. I can't even imagine. Can't even imagine. The timing is always the detail that you can't predict, because there's just no way to know. Some people better at it than others, but in terms of exact timing, too difficult. You know, it's just really hard. How do you do it? But the ultimate outcome, you know, you just know that what's going to happen. So. Right. I mean,
yeah. We saw a good example of what's going to happen earlier this year with the junior mining stocks. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of them trading as if they were bankruptcy candidates in late 2015. And by June and July of 2016, they had quadrupled or quintupled from those low levels. So if you didn't already own some of them, now you can buy them, but you have to pay four times as much. Right. So if there's a correction in the meantime, or even if there's not a correction, at some point, that mindset takes hold among the broader populace. Because this time around, the pop in gold and silver stocks was really localized. It wasn't the average investor buying these things. It was the people who had been watching them for a while and knew what they were and saw themselves missing the boat. So they all jumped in at once. When the average guy who right now owns, you know, the Standard & Poor's 500 and bank stocks and bond funds and things like that, when he looks around and says, oh my God, all my stuff is going down, what's left to buy? Oh, the junior miners are going up. Let me get some of that. When those people start jumping in, then forget it. The things that quadrupled through the first half of 2016 will do that again, but from that higher base, and maybe just keep on running after that. So it's getting to the point now where you kind of got to be adding to your portfolio of stuff like that, even at the risk of a correction in the short run, because the bigger risk is missing this phenomenal run that's out there when the Fed finally capitulates.
Yeah, and capitulate they will, because they're not going to have a choice. What is that going to mean to you? Well, you need to be prepared is what it means to you. So, John, I mean, things are so crazy. I mean, you ever really think 10 years ago, was it 12 years ago when you and James Turk wrote the first book, that things would shake out this way?
No. You know, back in 2004, James and I wrote a book called The Coming Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It. And I set up dollarcollapse.com as a little website. I thought that was a one-year gig, frankly. I thought I would watch the global financial system collapse and chronicle the collapse and then go on to other stuff, because the system at that time looked so untenable. It looked like it had to blow up. And, you know, it did. Just about blow up. According to the big banks, we were 1 week away from martial law in 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
So it almost happened. But then they brought us back from the brink with stuff that is, historically speaking, so experimental and so crazy that the average economist from, say, 1999, if you'd asked them about today's world, they would have said, oh, that's both impossible and really unwise. And yet here we are. You know, we did these things that that didn't seem conceivable a few decades ago. And now we're doing them. And because they're not really working, we're going on to the next level of stuff that also seems inconceivable, but by today's standards, you know, even in the new normal now, we're looking at some of the things that central banks are doing and are frankly kind of shocked by them. You know, for the Swiss central bank to be one of the biggest holders
really
of a long list of U.S. blue chip stocks, you know, or the European Central Bank, as we mentioned before, buying junk bonds from peripheral Eurozone countries that are themselves functionally bankrupt. That's just crazy because you're doing it with taxpayer money. When the central bank creates new currency, they're diluting the existing savings of their citizens. So they're basically taking money from their citizens, and they're using it now instead of buying sovereign debt. You know, when central banks were buying German bonds, that was at least using taxpayer money to buy relatively safe assets. But now when they're buying equities, which can go down by 50% in a bear market, or junk bonds, which can just evaporate and will evaporate in the case of a lot of the things that they're buying now, you're taking taxpayer money and you're basically rolling the dice with it. So yeah. I have a series on dollarclaps.com called We're All Hedge Funds Now. And I think it's time for an update. In that series, to take into account what central banks are doing now, because they really are hedge funds. I mean, the Swiss central bank, if it's got a long list of equities that it has now put taxpayer money into, how is that any different from a typical long short equities hedge fund? And it's not any different, except the central bank can create the money that it plays with, which in a way makes it an even more extreme version of a hedge fund than your typical hedge fund that has to go out to investors and get already existing money in order to play really highly dangerous leverage games. Well, a central bank can leverage itself to the hilt with a stroke of a pen or a click of a mouse now. And that's what they're doing. They're just creating currency out of thin air and using it to buy up highly risky assets. This is crazy. This is really off the scale crazy. No economists, again, you know, 20 years ago would have said that this was even possible under the rules that applied then. But we've just basically ignored all the rules that used to govern what central banks can do and can't do and should do and shouldn't do. You know, now we're just completely winging it. So the crisis that was inevitable in 2004 is now imminent. I think in the next few years, all of this blows up on us.
Yeah, it's looking more and more like that. It's just a little scary, but things keep going on until they don't anymore, right? And then they stop, and then the fun begins when the trend changes. And the trend is your friend as long as you're going with it. But when you stop, then or it changes and you don't, then the fun begins. So anyway, find John's work over at dollarcollapse.com, and you will always find a link in the show notes to our interviews on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Make sure you take a look at our new site that's coming up very shortly, our new homepage. Give your comments. We'd love to see them. And John, we will pick up where we left off next week, same time. All right.
Thanks, Gary. See ya.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.